Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
After debating this issue exhaustively for a year, let's move forward together.
Passing a health care bill is a lot like rolling a snowball up a hill. The further you push it, the bigger it gets. It would be really nice for Barack Obama if he had some help. Because the bigger it gets, the heavier it gets. As soon as you get near the top, it rolls back down.
Americans are demanding that President Obama and the Democrats in control of Congress scrap their misguided plan of a government takeover of health care.
She took a tiny bit and rolled it up again. She had to let it go. I saw it go straight down.
The White House is trying for one more push up the hill on health care. Is this the time they reach the top? Or is it just another snowball?
And it rolled back down. And it rolled back down.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 23rd. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry for the next couple of days, and I'm here with Celeste. You know, Celeste, the takeaway on healthcare for me is the president's latest proposal isn't that different from what we've seen before, so it's going to be interesting to see how they intend to get this one passed.
Maybe when they say reset, they mean reset how it came across to the public.
Maybe.
Let's get right to this top stories we're following this morning. Another blow to the Taliban's senior leadership this morning. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting Pakistani authorities have captured Mullah Kabir, a member of the group's inner circle and the leading military commander in eastern Afghanistan. The arrest appears to be a strictly Pakistani operation. Meanwhile, the Pentagon now says 21, not 27, Afghan civilians were killed by a NATO airstrike on Sunday. On Capitol Hill, a jobs bill is expected to pass the Senate tomorrow after five Republicans broke ranks to join Democrats in shutting down a filibuster. Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown was among them.
Staying on the Hill now, President Obama is trying to resurrect health reform, but this morning, House Republican Whip Eric Cantor called the president's proposal a warmed-over version of the Senate legislation the American people have already rejected. So what is new in this latest health care proposal from the president? We're joined now by Mary Agnes Carey. She's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News in Washington. Good morning, Mary Agnes.
Good morning.
Mary Agnes, the president says he's hitting the reset button, resetting the debate on health care. Does this proposal do that? Is it the reset button?
Well, it certainly might be trying to fast forward, trying to get new momentum into this bill, into discussions over the bill to try to get it over the finish line. The bill mirrors a lot of the provisions in the Senate package. It makes some changes in this Cadillac tax on the high-cost plans. It raises the threshold, but says it doesn't start for all the plans until about 2018, and that includes all health care plans. There's no carve-out specifically for the union plans that have been there before.
Okay.
He would give the federal government some new authority to regulate health insurance plans with an advisory board. He does a lot of things that are very similar in the bills. Medicaid expansion, cover more folks under Medicaid, more subsidies to help people purchase coverage.
Well, all these details, Mary Agnes, we're going to see if the reset for Republicans gets all the Democrats on board to see who it's a reset for. It's going to be incredibly important. Stay with us, Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, because we'll be back with you in just a moment.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney is said to be resting comfortably this morning in a Washington, D.C. hospital after experiencing chest pains last night. The 69-year-old has had four heart attacks and undergone bypass surgery in the past.
At the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, now, the United States won one medal last night, a silver in ice dancing. With 25 medals overall, the Americans have won as many as they did in the entire last Winter Games. The next big number is 34, their record for medals at any Winter Olympics. Moving on to the markets now, Asian markets were mixed. European indices are down and futures are also down. The Dow gets underway at 10,383. The S&P opens at 1,108 and the NASDAQ opens at 2,242. Coming up, we talk about work life every Tuesday, and with so many people looking for jobs and filling out applications, interview questions are frankly getting a little bit weird. We want to tell you how to navigate them and tell you the real answer if you're asked, if you walked into a room, what would your theme song be? Celeste, what would your theme song be?
Definitely, I'm a Survivor. I'm going to mention that later. Destiny's Child.
Oh, Destiny's Child. Oh,
that's mine. That's me, man, all the way.
And that's coming up later this hour.
More talk of healthcare in a moment.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here filling in for John Hockenberry for a couple of more days, and Celeste is here with me. President Obama unveiled his health care proposal yesterday. It's about 11 pages long, and if you were looking for a drastically different health care bill than the one that's faltered so far in Congress, this isn't it. The president has apparently ignored calls from Republicans to scrap his bill completely and start over with a blank sheet of paper. But nevertheless, he is trying to reset the debate. So to find out exactly what's in the proposal and what the president is trying to do, we're joined by Trudy Lieberman, contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, is back with us as well. Trudy, I want to start with you. What are the major parts of this proposal? What's in it that we haven't seen before already knocking around Congress?
Well, we have seen penalties for people who don't buy insurance, and they've been reduced somewhat in this bill, which of course raises the question whether people will take these lower penalties now, $325 for the first year the law is in effect, and or will they buy insurance at some price, and we don't know what the price is. The other thing that is new, which Mary Agnes alluded to a little bit ago, is this insurance oversight on the federal level. This plan by the president would set up this federal authority, which would take a look at some of these rate increases that insurance companies have been proposing and decide whether or not they are exorbitant and whether or not they should be reduced. It's not clear exactly how this is going to fit in with some of the state regulation, but there would be this other layer of oversight, and hopefully or perhaps jawbone the insurance companies into reducing the rates if there was no strong regulatory authority in the law. The excise tax has been tweaked a little bit.
Now you're talking about high-cost plans,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we're talking about the Cadillac, so-called Cadillac plans, the benefit, the plans that have richer benefits. These would now, the tax would now fall on union plans as well as non-union plans, and go into effect sometime after 2018. This is a little bit different than what was in the first bill, which was, basically it was an agreement not to tax the union negotiated plans for some period of time. So there's a little bit more equity here. Those plans are still somewhat problematic from a consumer standpoint, because if benefits are eventually reduced, as many experts think they will be, what does this do in terms of letting people go underinsured, which has been a big problem and has certainly been talked about a lot during this debate? So we really don't know what effect that will have either on saving money in the long run or in what people will have in coverage. We just know that it will happen and eventually affect about one quarter of the plan.
Well, let me ask Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News about this. Mary Agnes, what Trudy Lieberman is describing is a lot of tweaks apart from this new sort of federal crackdown on insurance companies raising their rates. Why, after the health care bill essentially stalling, if not failing, in Congress, would the president more or less retread proposals that the public seems to have said they don't like? Or is that what he's doing?
Well, the president has made a, I believe, and his advisors have made a political calculation that their best interest is to push for the biggest bill now, and that voters will punish them not only at the midterm elections but in subsequent elections if Democrats don't deliver on the big package. It's a risk. It's a gamble, but he's made this a top priority. He ran for it for the presidency, ran on this issue. A lot of members of Congress were elected on this issue, and he feels that he's, I think, going to use his political capital and push Democrats who might be reluctant to now embrace this to do so, and it's a decision that they've made.
So that this new proposal seems to be about getting Democrats in lockstep, not so much winning over Republicans, I guess. And I want to ask you about some numbers that are out there, Mary Agnes, because there's something that's really interesting. And some of the interesting polling numbers come from the Kaiser Family Foundation, where you work. Just by way of example, closing the Medicare prescription donut hole, a gap in Medicare coverage, that's in the bill. And according to polling, 68% of the public wants that. Ending discrimination against Americans with pre-existing conditions. According to the Washington Post ABC poll, 80% of Americans want that. Incredibly popular. And yet the bill that the president is proposing is essentially unpopular. Why is that?
Well, I think that it's viewed, a lot of the Republican talking points have gotten through to people. For example, you mentioned some of this Kaiser Family Foundation polling. There's actually a new health tracking poll out today, for example, right? To your point,
When asked, do you support health care reform, it split 43% for, 43% opposed, and the rest of the folks undecided. I think there's a lot of messages Republicans put out about the bill. It's going to be a government takeover. It's going to raise your health care costs. It's going to decimate the Medicare program. A lot of those messages have prevailed, but when they get into asking people about specific provisions, just as you noted, many polls show that people accept these provisions and want them and support them. So that's going to be the war for the White House and for Democrats that want to vote for this bill. How do you get that message to the public, and how do you get the public support behind this bill?
And Trudy, that would be my question to you. If Mary, if we are correct in saying that the provisions themselves are popular, but health care reform is not, as the bill itself is not, how can you then reset when you're not truly resetting?
Well, the problem has been, and we've observed this on CJR.org basically for the last 2 years, that what's in these bills, what the goal was, has not been effectively communicated to people by the White House or most other politicians as well. We've dealt a lot in slogans, affordable quality health care on the Democratic side, government-run health care on the Republican side. You can keep what you have if you have insurance from the White House. So I think what is in the bill, what it's been trying to do, has not been communicated effectively. And I went out and did my own little man-on-the-street interviews in New York on Saturday and found, indeed, the people I sampled in my very small scientific sample, that they are split and they do not understand what's in the bill. And if they have insurance, they say, well, it's not going to affect me. So I think the goals of reform, which have changed in the White House's mind, have not been effectively communicated. We first started out with universal coverage and now are ending up with insurance reform and deficit reduction. And so you can see this progression of shift in what health reform was supposed to do. And I would argue that the people have seen through that.
Well, Trudy, the White House has a challenge. As you say in your straw poll, people are split. Nationally, they seem to be split. And if the president is resetting, we'll see if he can reset with the public and with his own Democrats. Trudy Lieberman is contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and a healthcare specialist. Mary Agnes Carey, of course, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on some of the stories we're following.
U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood and Toyota executives will testify today at congressional hearings on the company's safety problems. Toyota's U.S. President James Lentz says Toyota had poor communications within the company, but also with U.S. government regulators and its customers. Top military leaders are also testifying this week on the Hill. They're focusing on whether gays and lesbians should be able to serve openly in the military. Yesterday, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, General Raymond Odierno, said sexual orientation should not keep anyone from enlisting.
My opinion is everyone should be allowed to serve, as long as we're still able to fight our wars.
Today, Congress will hear from top Army and Air Force chiefs. Overseas, Chinese authorities have tightened their control on the Internet. Now, anyone who wants to set up a website will have to speak to regulators in person and produce identity documents. The government says the new rules will target online pornography, but activists say it's just more government censorship.
In Afghanistan now, General Stanley McChrystal has apologized again for an airstrike that mistakenly targeted civilians. Today, McChrystal appealed directly to the Afghan people with a nationally televised video in which he pledged to regain their trust. At least 21 people were killed in the attack on Sunday. Finally, at home, visiting a hospital in the U.S. could be deadly, but not for the obvious reasons. A report out today says infections caught at U.S. hospitals killed nearly 50,000 patients and cost over $8 billion in 1 year alone. That was 2006. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, how $150 million from Bank of America to the federal government amounts to, quote, half-baked justice.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now we got some takeouts on the stories we want you to keep on top of today. A judge has approved a $150 million settlement between Bank of America and the SEC, which gets Bank of America out from under the weight of a persistent legal problem. New York Times finance reporter Louise Story has been following this story for us. Louise, $150 million, I have to say, in the world of Bank of America doesn't sound like too much money, but this goes all the way back to when Bank of America merged with Merrill Lynch, right?
That's right. Todd, if this sounds like deja vu to you, this is deja vu because Last August, the SEC and Bank of America settled. They went before the same judge, but at that time, the settlement was only $33 million, and the judge threw the settlement out. It was really a groundbreaking event in the banking and SEC regulatory world. He threw it out. So what you're seeing, what happened yesterday, is that the SEC and Bank of America came back with a new settlement, and it is higher. $150 million is higher than $33 million. The judge said this is still paltry. He had very harsh words. He said this is half baked justice at best. However, he said that he has to show some deference, and so he did approve it even while he criticized the SEC and the bank.
That's some incendiary rhetoric, I guess, from the judge in the case, who sounds like a pretty colorful character, and yet it does sound on the face of it, and I'm not on the inside of the case, obviously, that $150 million in B of A land is sort of nickels and dimes.
It is, but what we're talking about here is just the first of several cases Bank of America has to deal with regarding the Merrill merger. This case is over the fact that Bank of America did not disclose huge losses that Merrill Lynch had right before the merger, and they didn't disclose huge bonuses that Merrill was, you know, paying, pushing out the door, money they were pushing out the door before the merger. And the judge was very clear. The bank has continued to say that these non-disclosures were not a problem, but the judge was very clear that if shareholders had known this information, he said, they would have thought twice about approving the merger, or they might have sought its renegotiation. So the judge very clearly established that shareholders were wronged, and this will have implications in many shareholder lawsuits against the bank, as well as a case that's still pending by the Attorney General of New York.
So the cost may come later on. It seems like up to this point, paying $150 million for not disclosing big bonuses or big losses might have been worth the money for Bank of America. I don't
know. Right, well, but the cost may be coming.
They may be coming later. Louise Story from the New York Times. Thanks.
And now for a takeout from Vancouver, Jason Stallman is with us again. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Women figure skaters are going to be on the ice tonight for their short programs. Lots of things going on. The U.S. men took gold in figure skating. So, Jason, anyone among the U.S. women expected to have a shot at a medal?
Frankly, the Americans don't really have a strong contender in this field. We'll have 30 skaters going in the short program, 2 minutes 50 seconds each, and the best the Americans have to offer is probably Rachel Flatt. She's solid, but she's really not on par with some of the skaters from Japan and South Korea. This one's expected to go down to Kim Yuna, a South Korean skater who's trying to win the first figure skating gold for that country, and her main rivals are Mao Asada, Miki Ando of Japan.
Well, Rachel Flatt is quite young. Isn't she only like 17 years old?
She is. She's a straight-A student at Cheyenne High School in Colorado Springs, as a matter of fact.
Proud parents.
Absolutely.
So I assume that we're expecting that our young skaters, because 16-year-old Mira Nagasu. Yes, we're expecting them to grow into this sport, maybe come back in 4 years and be a little bit more strong contenders.
That's certainly the hope, and Nagasu does have a lot of potential. She's certainly the United States' most colorful personality, but right now there's a pretty big gulf between Nagasu, Rachel Flatt, and the skaters from Japan and Kim Yuna of Korea.
Well, it'll still be a very well-watched and enjoyed short program, the Olympics event tonight. Jason Stallman, thanks so much. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times.
Now for our last takeout, we turn the microphone over to you, the listeners. Our series, Frustration Nation, continues. And later this morning, what's really got you really frustrated? As one listener put it, it's congressional constipation.
I'm tremendously frustrated with the gridlock in Congress.
That's Jay in Detroit calling us on 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I am even more frustrated with the fact that the media has, with the exception of Rachel Maddow, has done virtually nothing to explain filibuster and why there's gridlock to the American public.
Now, Jay, we'll be talking more about your frustration, the media, later this morning. But when we heard from many of you, most of you were irritated by the stalling on one topic, health care.
This is Joel Ryan from Littleton, Colorado. And I think health care reform is stumbling because everyone's focused on insurance companies and costs and Byzantine systems like Medicare. So people need to be looking at what's going on with health care reform and our families.
Some of you are also pretty nice and had some advice for the kiddos on Capitol Hill.
My name is Juan. I'm calling from Miami. To fix the system is quite simple. Limit corporate contributions to campaigns.
This is Miranda from South Carolina. I'm pretty frustrated with what's going on in Washington. I think since they can't accomplish anything to save us all some money, they should vote themselves a 20% pay cut and take a couple of furlough days to help bring down that budget deficit.
Miranda, I hate to say it. Do you think it was hard to pass health care and wait till you try to pass a 20% salary cut in Washington? But we always want your takes. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the phone number to call, or you can post your comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. And today we're still asking you about what you're frustrated with in government. But today we want to ask you a very specific question. Many of you blame the media for some of the gridlock, and we're wondering, was there a specific moment when you felt just incredibly frustrated or something that sticks out in your mind as an example of perhaps it was media coverage or perhaps it's something else, of an example of this gridlock in Washington? Let us know your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post a comment at thetakeaway.org.
I think if I could change one thing about media coverage, it would just be the volume. Just the volume of it, the amplitude, sometimes just a little bit too loud for my taste. Coming up, though, the Pentagon says 21 Afghan civilians are dead after a failed NATO airstrike on Sunday. For the details of what went wrong and the consequences of a mistake like that, we'll be covering it in just a few minutes.
You know, you can turn the volume down.
I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry for a couple of more days. Coming up, the Pentagon reports 21 Afghan civilians are dead after a failed NATO airstrike on Sunday. We'll hear exactly what went wrong and the consequences of such a mistake. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 31 minutes after the hour. President Obama hopes to keep his push for health care reform alive. Yesterday, he released an 11-page proposal that builds on legislation passed by both houses of Congress. Dr. David Stevens, the CEO of the Christian Medical Association, says this may be the president's last shot.
What seems so dead has been resurrected and is back on the table. The question is whether it's still dead and people just are pretending it's alive.
Republicans say the president's proposals are nothing new.
Even as Americans were footing the bill for the financial bailouts, Wall Street paid more than $20 billion of bonuses last year, and that's up 17% from the year before. New York officials say the profit for all of Wall Street could top $55 billion. Millions of Americans are tweeting every day, but Twitter still far behind Facebook when it comes to users. Twitter had 24 million unique visitors last month. Facebook attracted 134 million. Still, in 2009, the number of people joining Twitter grew by 1,400%. And if your mother threw out your comic books when you were a kid, be sure to tell her about this story. A rare copy of the first comic book featuring Superman has sold now for $1 million. Vincent Cersola arranged the sale, and he tells the BBC, "We've all seen this comic."
The cover of the comic book features a picture of Superman about to throw a green car over his head. It's a classic image that most people who know anything about comic books will recognize.
Comic dates back to 1938 with an original cover price of 10 cents. Checking on the markets, the Dow will start at 10,383, the S&P at 1,108, and the NASDAQ at 2,242. Futures are down. Those are some of the stories you're following this morning.
A NATO airstrike on Sunday killed 21 Afghan civilians in a region northeast of Helmand Province, Afghanistan. Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, expresses regret over the incident.
I do offer my heartfelt condolences not only to the loved ones of those killed in this incident, but to the Afghan people themselves, and to the family and friends of all those killed or wounded thus far in this operation, Afghan and coalition alike.
Now, this was the third such incident by NATO in Afghanistan. For more on what exactly happened, we're joined from Kabul by Rod Nordland, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. To start off, Rod, from the military perspective, the targeting of this convoy that resulted in this mistake, it clearly was a mistake. So what happened?
Well, what appears to have happened is that some American Special Forces helicopters were hunting for Taliban who had escaped from Marja, which is quite a long ways away from where this happened, about 150 miles away. And they saw several truckloads of people and for some reason assumed that they were insurgents and opened fire on them. And apparently all of them were civilians, including women and children. Now, NATO says that there was a patrol in the area, a patrol of its forces on the ground, and that they were under some impression that these vehicles were on their way, were Taliban on their way to attack them. But how you square that account and the account of the helicopters is a little difficult to work out at this point, and they're not saying very much.
They're not saying much about that, and it's difficult to know because this is a pretty clear departure, it seems, from the stated policy of NATO under the command of General Stanley McChrystal. Last June, as you write, there was a shift in policy restricting the use of airstrikes, and this seems to have violated that restriction.
Yeah, and if you read the statement that they put out, I mean, McChrystal's quoted as saying that he has told his forces that incidents like this should not happen, and it sounds like he's quite upset about it. He immediately went over to the president's palace Sunday night to apologize in person and to explain to Karzai exactly why, what went wrong. He's not explaining that to us, so we don't really know the details, but we do know from the Afghan military that it was apparently American Special Forces helicopters.
Does Stanley McChrystal believe, do you think, that this is the worst possible news at the worst possible time? After all, the overall strategy as American and NATO forces push into Marja is to minimize civilian casualties and let the locals know that we're on their side.
Yes, and it's been not only a cornerstone of his policy, but it's been something that's been extremely important to Afghans. They were fed up during the Bush administration with repeated airstrikes that killed, you know, in some cases, hundreds of civilians. And during that period, the American military and NATO just basically stonewalled, lied, covered it up, didn't talk about it. And Afghans got increasingly furious about it, and it's something that really strikes a chord with them. Now, since McChrystal's policy, there really has only been one major incident, which was in Kunduz. And Kunduz, back in September, was a little bit of a gray area because it was a military target, although a lot of civilians were killed because they were at the target. At least it was a military target. This is the first case of a straight-out airstrike that killed a bunch of civilians where there was apparently no question that they were involved in any kind of insurgency.
Thank you, Rod Nordland, for foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times in Kabul.
And clearly, for a strategy that involves a small number of civilian deaths, this is a setback. We're joined now by Dr. Nadir Atash. He's a former Afghan government official. He was there from 2002 to 2006 and author of Turbulence, The Tumultuous Journey of One Man's Quest for Change in Afghanistan. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Nadir, we've heard already that Afghans are not happy about the deaths of women and children in this airstrike. And we are always here as well that these kind of civilian deaths send people into the ranks of the Taliban. Do you think that's the case in here, in this situation?
Unfortunately, I think that would be the case, because the recent incident is not just something new. As your other guest indicated, this is one among a series of mishaps that have occurred from 2001 onwards. And we are fast losing the trust of Afghans. Think of it in this way, that the Afghans wholeheartedly supported the intervention of the U.S. NATO. And a lot of promises were made to improve their lives, but very little has been delivered. And on top of it, they get a corrupt government, lack of rule of law, injustices and atrocities committed on them by the government and that we have supported. And all they receive is death and nothing to improve their lives. I think we need to seriously deliver on some of those promises and quickly, and to regain the trust of people and take measures, appropriate measures in that regard.
We've been told by people on the ground in Afghanistan that Afghans, to a certain extent, expected civilians to be injured or killed in any kind of war that was going on in their country. So help me understand how each civilian death sends people going to the Taliban. How what kind of culture is there in Afghanistan that makes that reaction happen?
The Afghan code of conduct is strongly emphasizes kinship and family, and those values are with us throughout more than thousands of years. And what happens when something happens to a family which the family does not deserve that kind of a incident, then they would do anything in their power to revenge that. And not only that, but it's not only this family, but the entire population in Afghanistan that would sympathize with insurgents given these kind of mishaps and incidents.
That's Dr. Nadir Attash, former Afghan government official. Thanks so much. Coming up, we're talking about work life, as we do every Tuesday. And with so many people looking for a job, hundreds of applications for every open spot, there are some interview questions that are downright quirky. One of them is, what would be your theme music if you walked into a room? That's an actual interview question. Todd?
Well, you know me. I always fall back on David Bowie in these situations. Young Americans, all the way from Washington.
You know? Okay, you can only use that song for a few more years. But, great. We're asking our listeners.
I just got that.
Zing. We're asking our listeners, what would be your theme music? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE, thetakeaway.org. Todd's very young. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Distressing news for the French wine industry. French exports of expensive champagne and cognacs suffered a record 17% drop last year. People were drinking less, and they switched to cheaper brands from the U.S. and Britain. Those are the largest foreign markets. So what does this mean? Is it an end to French domination in the wine industry? We're joined now by Bénédicte Pavillot. She's the U.K. correspondent for the international channel France 24. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Bonjour.
Bonjour. Bon matin. I don't know what time it is there. But why are Americans turning away from French wine? Is it just the price?
Well, that would probably be the case, because that's true also here in Britain. Unfortunately, many people choose the alcohol they're consuming, whether that's in a bar, a cafe, or in a shop, according to the price. Now, as a truly French girl, I'm well-educated and raised, I hope it's a blessing, with quality, not quantity, I think that that's very sad, because I think that price is not everything, and it's better, well, I would say like clothes or jewelry, to have something of value and that is, well, of good quality, rather than having lots of it. And it's rotgut, as they call it over here, and vinegar. So I find that rather sad. Unless we think that everybody's becoming incredibly healthy and now consuming less alcohol. I'm not sure I believe that.
I don't believe that either. And I'm going to totally ignore the fact that you just called American wine vinegar. But is it...
Hold on. Let me correct that. I would not at all. I wouldn't want a diplomatic incident. Far be it from me. And if that was misconstrued, I apologize profusely. I've had fantastic wines from the Napa Valley at Zinfandel that I've never found again. But no, I would never accuse that. I was talking generally, it's true, of French, Spanish, Italian, any wines. I was talking about quality, not nationality.
Right. So what is it that makes French wines in general more expensive? Oftentimes people feel like it's just because they have a French name.
Well, that's probably, I would say that that's a cliched view. I think that where the French market does have a problem is that the Anglo-Saxon market has really has these grapes. It looks at Syrah or other types of grapes, and that is something that the French wine market has been very slow to pick up on, is that Anglo-Saxons want to know what kind of grape is going to the wine. The French way of doing things is the château, it's the terroir, where it's come from, the
region.
The region, exactly. Terroir coming from the word earth, and quality, if you want, that not only of the local climate, the microclimate, and the tradition and the culture. So I think that that's one of the reasons. I think, of course, then when you export, it, obviously you have the taxes of the country. French wine is much more expensive in Britain, for example, as well, than if you were to hop over the channel and go and, you know, load up, which a lot of British people do. What I can reassure you about is that the biggest consumer actually in the world of champagne outside France is Britain, and that doesn't look like it's going down anytime soon. But I think that, on the other hand, I think New Zealand particularly and Australia, New World Wines, to a lesser extent in the UK, American wines, have promoted themselves extremely well. And so if you get the right, you know, a low price, then I think that people are very excited by that.
And I have to say, Bénédicte, sometimes it's easier to pronounce Giulio Gallo's wine than it is to pronounce the wine from the Château and the Terroir in France. Bénédicte Pavillot is a UK correspondent for the international channel France 24. She's talking about the huge reduction in sales of French exports of champagne. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley. I'm here with Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John Hockenberry. John will be back on Thursday. And we're talking about work today. With more people looking for a job, that means lots of people are filling out more applications than they normally do. And maybe you've noticed some strange questions showing up, like, what kind of tree would you be if you could choose? Or what kind of marine animal would you be? We're going to talk about how to answer those questions in just a few minutes. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. A jobs bill is expected to pass in the Senate tomorrow after five Republicans joined Democrats to shut down a filibuster last night. The bill would allow businesses that hire new workers to get tax breaks. Moving on to Afghanistan, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, says the fighting is not easy, but U.S. troops are making progress against the Taliban in the south.
I think we're headed in the right direction. We got the right leadership, the right strategy, the right resources, and I think we can succeed.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon has approved $150 million in military assistance for Yemen. That's more than double what the U.S. gave the country last night.
Back at home, two big-name Republicans are in the hospital. Former Vice President Dick Cheney is at George Washington University Hospital after experiencing chest pains. And former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole is at Walter Reed Army Medical Center recuperating from pneumonia. And finally, at the Winter Games in Vancouver, U.S. skaters Charlie White and Merrill Davis took silver in ice dancing yesterday. Now, last night on Comedy Central, Stephen Colbert asked Olympic snowboarder Sean White about the difference between snowboarders and ice dancers.
How come you guys don't burst into tears when you're done?
I don't know.
What is the difference in temperament, do you think, there?
I imagine that they got to be sitting there like, I wore this outfit and I still didn't even win, you know what I mean?
Sean White hurtling down the slopes in an Aboriginal costume, maybe. The latest win in ice dancing brings the U.S. medal count to 25, followed by Germany with 21. Those are some of the top stories we're following this morning.
Talk about work, and the new statistic says that there's now six unemployed Americans for every available job. That doesn't sound like a lot, but actually when you average that out, that's a lot of people applying for every open position, hundreds of applications for single spots. And there's some strange questions appearing on some of these applications. Many people are noticing them because they're filling out more applications, probably, than they normally would. Joining us to explain is our work contributor, Beth Kobliner. And also with us is Connie Thanasoulis-Seracchio. She's Vault.com's career expert and the former staffing head for Citigroup and Merrill Lynch. So, Beth, first off, I want to play this comment from Human Resources Director of Zappos. That's the online shoe retailer. This is Rebecca Ratner.
Zappos asks employees a number of different questions that may be considered a little weird or strange. How weird you are, how lucky you are, or even what kind of theme music might play in a room when you walked in.
What theme music might play in a room when you walked in, Beth?
I think yours is Wild Thing, Celeste. I've been pondering this for a while.
I pick for my own theme music Destiny's Child, I'm a Survivor.
There you go.
But this is a good question for our listeners. I want to throw this question out to all of our listeners out there. If you had theme music that played when you walk into a room, give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE and tell us what your theme music would be. But Beth, back to Zappos.com. How is that? Why are people asking that question on job applications?
Well, I guess one reason is that it is certainly intriguing to hear what people are going to say, but more and more companies are doing this, and it's not sort of the randy, quirky interviewer. It's companies, corporations, actually putting in place these companies as a way to suss out this huge volume of people who want to be employees. It started in the 90s with Microsoft. They asked those sort of brain teaser questions like, why is a manhole cover round? How would you build an alarm clock for deaf people? How would you explain to use Microsoft to your grandmother? Those kind of questions. And now Target asks questions like, how much do you daydream? One person wrote in from a website called Glassdoor.com, where people write in all these kind of questions that they've asked. And she said, Best Buy asked if both a taxi and a limo were priced at the exact same, which one would you choose? So there are all these kind of interesting questions. If you were an item in a supermarket, what would you be? They're trying to figure out how the respondent, how the applicant would either handle the pressure or sort of respond in a way that might suit the culture of the company.
Okay, so Connie Thanasoulis-Seracchio, you are with Vault.com, you're their career expert, but you also were the former staffing head for Citigroup and Merrill Lynch. What are companies trying to find out with these questions?
Well, you know, there are a lot of very good qualified candidates out there, and we really have to cut through the quick to make sure we have the right person, the person who fits the corporation the best. And a lot of times, if the corporation is fast, dynamic, entrepreneurial, we might ask, you know, what kind of a car would you be? Well, a Lamborghini would be a great answer. You might want to talk about how bright the red is on a Lamborghini, and, you know, because we don't want to hire a minivan type of person. So it really has to do with the culture of the organization, and it also has to do with the creative nature of the candidate. We want someone who's not only really good at the basic skills of a job, we want someone who is extraordinary in their thought processes, in how they think about themselves. We want someone who's confident enough to talk about what kind of a tree would they be. You know, I'd be an oak tree. I want to be as tall and strong. I want to reach towards the sky higher than any other tree. You know, I want to outperform anyone else at this company.
You know, Beth, but yeah, I have to ask you, how do you answer these questions right?
Right.
I mean, can you be completely honest? Because I don't think you can.
No, I mean, you can't. And also, I sort of question what kind of methodological study has been done that shows that somebody says a Lamborghini is better than a minivan. You know, like what really will prove that? But I do think that if a question is completely bizarre, the advice is you have to just go with it. No matter what the interviewer is asking you, they're asking you for a reason. So try to answer with a straight face. They want to see if you're going to get frazzled, so don't get angry. They want to see if you could think on your feet, keep cool, just do your best. You know, 40% of interviewers spend less than 30 minutes asking people questions for a job, so you're not going to have a lot of time to prove yourself. So if you're thrown one of these questions, you want to make sure to make a good impression and just keep it cool, take it seriously. And you should know that if there's no right or wrong. And generally speaking, you know, one person said, if it's a high pressured company, say you're a tiger. If it's a low pressured company, say you're a squirrel. I don't know, you know, but no matter what it is, you want to come up with something that sounds fairly reasonable and keep the interview moving.
Okay, so Connie, let me ask this question to you. You heard what Beth just said. I would never pick a Lamborghini because I have all kinds of negative associations with middle-aged men that drive sports cars. Not in, you know, just because we've had all this news about, you know, midlife crises. That's what I associate a Lamborghini with. So how can you tell from these answers?
Well, you know, you have to, you must practice. You have to practice interview questions that are traditional and non-traditional so that you're comfortable with what comes out and it makes sense. So when you practice the traditional questions, you're going to feel more confident should an untraditional question come your way. So you have to be, there is no right or wrong answer, as Beth said, but you have to show enthusiasm. You have to show that you're having fun with yourself. There is no right or wrong answer,
okay,
but you're going to do the best you can do, because that's what an interview is all about. When someone interviews, they're in the lead, you have to follow.
All right, that's Connie Thanasoulis-Siracchio. She's a career expert with Vault.com. Also, we heard from our Takeaway Work contributor, both Beth Kobliner. If you want more from Beth, she wrote a blog post about the sweeping credit card rules changes that came into effect yesterday. What do these changes mean for you and your monthly bill? You can check out on, just go to thetakeaway.org and click on blog.
And while while we don't have a job for you, unfortunately, we do want to know, when you walk into a room, what would your theme song be?
When I walk in a room, I guess mine would be the shark motif from Jaws. Sustain it himself lovely.
Hi, this is Leah from Detroit, Michigan, and my theme music is Golden by Jill Scott.
Troy calling from Dakota. My theme song for when I walk into a room, song number 2 by Blur. Ding, 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 ding,
ding. We've got to recover for a second. Tell us yours at 8778MyTake or post to the website, thetakeaway.org. You know, that Jaws shark music reminded me a little bit of some of our editorial meetings sometimes, maybe when the boss comes in. I don't know, here at the takeaway. I'm just making fun of the boss.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, Celeste is just looking. You're on your own, buddy. while you're at the site, sign up for the podcast to catch up on anything you missed in the show. You can also get a sneak peek on the topics we're working on for the next few days, and you can sign up for our newsletter. That's all at thetakeaway.org. And we also want to hear who you think is having a good week and a bad week. Our friends at The Week magazine tally that up every Friday, but we want to hear your suggestions so that when we get to Friday, we can have your suggestions in the spot. That's at thetakeaway.org, and tune in on Friday to hear the results. I'm Todd Zwillick.
What's your theme song?
Oh, Young Americans, David Bowie.
That's right. And my theme song, I'm a Survivor, Baby. This is Celeste Headlee, and this is The Takeaway. Most people think the government is broken.
I'm beyond disgusted about how broken and constipated the Senate is.
Totally frustrated with this crazy Congress.
Grow up, people. Who put them there in the first place?
Even other politicians are joining the chorus of voices who say stop bickering and get to work.
If you really want to serve the people and not just your party, I think you will find that sweet spot, right, and you can get it done.
That's Arnold Schwarzenegger telling politicians to get it together. But many others have a familiar complaint. It's the media's fault.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us.
Jon Stewart famously told Tucker Carlson that he was hurting America. Harsh words, strong words, true words. This time, is it really the media's fault? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 23rd, and Todd Zwillick joins me again today while John is out. John returns on Thursday.
Good morning, Celeste. We're going to be continuing our series Frustration Nation with a look at the media in just a couple of minutes. But first, let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Toyota's U.S. president is apologizing for the company's poor handling of its safety problems. James Lentz acknowledges the automaker took too long to confront safety issues. The admission comes hours before Lentz will testify before Congress, where federal investigators have opened a criminal probe into Toyota. Tomorrow, it's the CEO's turn to answer questions. Meanwhile, another Taliban leader has been caught in Pakistan. Our partner, The New York Times, is reporting Pakistani authorities have captured Mullah Kabir, a member of the group's inner circle and the leading military commander in eastern Afghanistan.
Here at home, there was a rare moment of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill last night. Five Republican senators broke ranks with their party and voted to advance a Democratic jobs bill. As the White House celebrates getting some Republican support, Democratic Governor Jennifer Granholm from Michigan tells MSNBC this morning, both parties have got to work together.
Republicans realize that you cannot slash the heck out of the safety net in this country. Democrats realize you can't raise taxes all the time. Yeah. You got to come together.
Our series Frustration Nation continues today. We're talking about the media's role in the gridlock in Congress. And joining us now is Kathleen Hall Jamison. She's director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kathleen, is there merit to this argument that the gridlock in Washington is caused by the media?
No, blaming the media for causing the problem is like blaming the family dog or the in-laws for a divorce. Small part of the problem, yes. Central to the problem, no.
Okay, we're going to talk more about this in just a minute. Kathleen Hall Jamison, stay with us.
Meanwhile, at the Olympics in Vancouver, the United States won one medal last night, a silver in ice dancing. Meryl Davis, part of the American pair, tells NBC News this morning.
To be sitting on top of the podium with Scott and Tessa just feels so amazing. We're so proud of them because we train with them on a daily basis, and I can't even keep it together. But, you know, there's just so much to be proud of for all of us.
Ice dancing is a very emotional pursuit, I have to say. They really get into it. Now, with 25 medals, Americans have won as many as they did in the entire last Winter Games. The next big number is 34, the record number for medals at any Winter Olympics. Turning to the markets now, Asian markets were mixed. European indices are down, and futures are also down. The Dow gets underway at 10,383. The S&P opens at 1,108, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,242. Coming up, we give you a behind-the-scenes look at who exactly we're fighting in Afghanistan. We talk about a new frontline documentary behind Taliban lines later this hour.
Our series Frustration Nation continues in just a few minutes. But you know what people like to complain about almost as much as politics?
What's that?
The media.
Yes, they do.
We're talking about the media's role. Is the media us? Are we at fault in any way, shape, or form for the gridlock in Washington? It's a serious question, and it's what we're asking you. If you're frustrated by what's going on in Washington right now, do you hold the media responsible? And if there's any one incident you can point to that demonstrates that, let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to have more of that conversation coming up. If you've watched any news on the cable channels recently, you might recognize this.
Washington is broken, and our country's in deep trouble financially.
He can't get through the health care. He can't get cap and trade. He can't get through immigration reform.
Is the government broken? Sure, it's broken.
We're continuing our series of Frustration Nation today, and we're asking this question. How much of this dysfunction is being driven by the media's obsessive coverage of the bickering in Washington? Are we reporting the story of political stagnation, or are we perpetuating it? We've called upon two media experts to help us sort through this. Joining us again, Kathleen Hall Jamison, the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And also with us is Michael Kinsley. He's the founder of Slate and a former co-host on Crossfire, now a current columnist for The Atlantic. Kathleen Hall Jamison, let me go back to you. We have a 24-hour news and headline-driven news culture. So when media organizations have to fill 24 hours, can they really be blamed for getting headlines out of what may be considered trivial stories?
More importantly, the media are able to digest complex issues in short segments if they want to. Republican plan, cap malpractice awards, Republican plan, you'll be able to buy insurance across state lines. Democratic plan, you'll be able to carry your insurance until you're 26 if you're a student. Democratic plan, if you're ill, you'll still be able to get insurance. The complexities of plans can be reduced to short segments. The question is, does the media do it, and does the media do it well? Sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't.
Okay, Michael, I want to replay this very well-known and viral clip from Jon Stewart when he was on Crossfire a few years back, and he was talking to Tucker Carlson.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You have a responsibility to the public discourse, and
you
fail miserably.
Michael Kinsley, is the media failing in its responsibility to public discourse?
Oh, I don't think so. I thought that Jon Stewart clip was a little unfair. The media have a few relatively minor flaws that have affected the health care debate. They're obsessed too much with politics instead of the policy. The most important question about health care is not what effect it will have on Obama's chances of reelection. The important question is, will it help address the problems of people not getting coverage and costs going up? And the media also have this iron law that the story has to change. Obama was up, now he's got to be down, at least for a while. And I think those things they're guilty of. But in terms of being responsible for the ugliness of the debate and the lack of progress, I think that's more or less a bum rap.
Okay, but just to play devil's advocate here for just a second, isn't there also a question of accuracy? In other words, very oftentimes I'll see reports or I'll read them in newspapers in which they directly quote someone out of Washington, and within that quote there will be three or four inaccuracies, untruths. Not just spin, but things that are just not entirely true. And they print those quotes without the journalist coming back and saying, that's not actually accurate, here's the fact. Don't journalists have a responsibility to point out when something isn't right?
Yes, and you're right. It's a terrible problem for journalism. What do you do when one side of the debate is simply telling lies, as you said? I think that over recent decades, journalism has actually gotten better at this. It goes back at least to Joe McCarthy, when he started accusing people of being communists. Newspapers didn't know what to do because people are demanding that you be objective and not take a view yourself. At the same time, people get upset, naturally and rightly, when they hear lies being uncorrected. I think, you know, that these days they cover TV commercials for during election season, and they do a much better job than they used to, although not perfect, at not letting lies just sit there.
Okay, Kathleen Hall Jamison, let me kind of turn that a little bit and talk about the emphasis in media on having equal balance between two sources. In other words, I hear reports in which they'll say the Republicans say this particular thing, and they'll run a quote of it. And then they come back, and instead of saying, you know, commenting on what that says, they'll come back and say, the Democrats say this. And so the journalist never has to put themselves on the line and say actually what's true or what's not. They just get quotes from the two camps. Does that contribute to kind of the argument sort of situation, turning everything into an argument?
It contributes to public confusion. And we know that when there's a focus on tactics rather than substance, that we see in experiments an increase in cynicism and a depression in learning. But we also, with the advent in particular of the Internet, have a way for individuals who are confused by some forms of news or who see distortions or wonder whether something's distortion to go to places like, and this is a self-interested plug, factcheck.org, or PolitiFact, or Michael Dobbs' excellent journalism at the Washington Post. So regardless of when you're confused, there's always someplace on the Internet to go to see if somebody's fact-checked it. That's one really important change in journalism.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, Todd Zwillick here. And a lot of people in Washington where I work, you know, roll their eyes when they see trivial coverage. And I've always wondered if that doesn't bring a lot of people to the table. You know, they come maybe for a little bit of entertainment, but they stay for substance.
If that brings people to substance because there then is substance there, you could make that argument. Unfortunately, in many of the genres that introduce programming like that, the rest of the programming continues the discussion about the relative merits of writing on one's hand.
Michael Kinsley, last question for you. There are a number of problems. I mean, even if, as you say, it's not the media's fault that there's gridlock in Washington, there's problems of using sources that perhaps are dubious, going constantly to bloggers for opinions and turning things into an argument for headline's sake. How do we fix it?
Well, I guess you're trying to do that with your program. I think, a lot of media criticism can help, although my wife and other people say you people are so self-involved. Get over yourselves when the press chooses to chew over some issue involving itself. I think the Internet certainly means that anyone who wants to can get out there and express a view, and there are people who come from nowhere and end up being quite influential. It's been a great improvement.
Okay, Michael Kinsley is a founder of Slate, former co-host at Crossfire, and columnist at The Atlantic. Kathleen Hall Jamison is the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. This conversation is part of our continuing series that we're calling Frustration Nation, and we're going to our listeners again to get your take on this. Do you think the media is responsible in any way for the gridlock going on in Washington? Is there anything that has bothered you particularly? And you have any solutions for us? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment to thetakeaway.org. It's now 15 minutes after the hour. Let's check in on the headlines.
U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has made some tough comments about NATO. In a meeting in Europe this morning, he said some European NATO partners are averse to using military force, and that's limiting the coalition's ability to fight effectively. Gates said the alliance needs major reform. Meanwhile, NATO forces in Afghanistan are reporting some progress in the fight for the city of Marja. Back at home, top military officials are testifying on the Hill. They're focusing on whether gays and lesbians should be able to serve openly in the military. Yesterday, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, General Ray Odierno, said sexual orientation shouldn't keep anyone from enlisting.
My opinion is everyone should be allowed to serve, as long as we're still able to fight our wars.
Today, the Congress gets testimony from top Army and Air Force chiefs.
The president is calling the jobs bill a good first step. If passed, the bill would give tax breaks to businesses that hire new workers. It faces a final vote tomorrow. Former Vice President Dick Cheney is resting comfortably in a Washington hospital after experiencing chest pains. Cheney has had four heart attacks, the first when he was just 37 years old. And finally, today's events at the Winter Games in Vancouver include freestyle skiing, figure skating, and bobsledding. Yesterday, the U.S. took a silver medal in ice dancing, losing the gold to the Canadians. The women's U.S. ice hockey team, though, will play Canada in the finals on Thursday for the gold. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up...
Do that voodoo that you do so well.
Walmart is doing that voodoo that it does so well. They're not talking about black magic. They are talking about selling movies over the internet. They've purchased a service called Voodoo. Will it work? We'll talk about it.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John Hockenberry for a couple of more days. And we've got some takeouts now on the stories we're following this week. A report out of Congress says Toyota misled the public on its safety problems, which caused unintended acceleration in some Toyota cars. Kate Linebaugh covers the auto industry for The Wall Street Journal, and she's with us now. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
This report out of Congress on Toyota, what exactly do they say went wrong?
Oh, well, they say a number of things went wrong, mainly, as you said, that Toyota misled the public with some public statements earlier this month, but also that Toyota has resisted the possibility of electronic failures and then provided and hasn't done enough to investigate the electronics in the vehicles. The misleading the public comes from some statements made by Toyota's U.S. sales chief earlier in the month, where he said on the Today Show and other programs that the fix for the sticky pedal showed that the company had everything under control, and Congress is challenging that and saying also that Toyota officials in their communications with Congress said that the sticky pedal issue is not at all linked to high-speed sudden acceleration, and so therefore I guess Congress is challenging Toyota for conflating the sticky pedal problem with the sudden acceleration problem that is really at the heart of this whole thing.
Well, there might be some light shining on federal regulators as well, because we had some news earlier this week that Toyota actually negotiated some recall terms with the federal government. So we'll see where this story goes. Kate Linebaugh covering the auto industry for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
And now for another takeout from the Olympics. Jason Stallman joins us again. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. Jason, let's talk about the ice dancing competition first. Who walked away with medals last night?
In ice dancing, finally, Canada had a little something to celebrate. They've had so many disappointments reaching the podium so far in the Vancouver Games, but Scott Moir and Tessa Virtue had another nearly flawless performance. First gold medal ever in ice dancing for a team from North America, and it's only the third time that a team not from Russia or the Soviet Union won gold in that event.
Oh, nice. Well, yay, Canada.
Canada and the United States comes away with silver. Merrill Davis, Charlie White, a couple of students at the University of Michigan. They finished second to Moir and Virtue.
Go blue. Coming up today, we have the men's giant slalom ski race. Two veteran U.S. skiers, Ted Ligety and Bodie Miller, are going to be carrying the hopes for the U.S. men. But we've got two other U.S. skiers, too, also Tommy Ford and Jake Szymanski. These are their first Olympics for them. Any medal contenders among the Americans?
Well, certainly, I think everyone by now is persuaded by Bodie Miller that he's back and stronger than ever. So he's a presence in the giant slalom. But this is Ted Ligety's specialty. So I think Ligety might be considered even more of a favorite to win a gold or silver than Bodie. Ligety's number 7 in the start list, so he'll have an early run. Miller goes a little while later. So certainly two medal contenders for the United States in the giant slalom today.
However, if Bodie Miller does happen to win, he could be the first man to win 4 alpine skiing medals.
Right, and that would be, he's already been a huge surprise, but if he comes away from Vancouver with 4 or more medals, that will be absolutely stunning. He's already being considered one of the greatest alpine skiers of all time, and that would certainly only strengthen that case.
Definitely would underline his name in the history books. Thanks so much, Jason Stallman, the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times.
And now business, and that means Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Louise, the Times has an exclusive this morning from your colleague Brad Stone on how Walmart might soon start selling movies over the internet. Is this Walmart's version of cut-rate Netflix films? Why are they getting into this business?
Good morning, Todd. Walmart sells a lot of DVDs. So they're looking at the future and they're saying, we've got to be in the beaming business. We've got to be able to beam movies to people because the DVD business is going away. Now, remember, Walmart did this a couple years ago with Hewlett-Packard. They set up a website where you could download videos. It didn't work. It flopped. And so what they're doing now is they're buying this company, Voodoo, which is a program that connects with HDTV. So instead of having to have a separate box, it's built right into the HDTV, and you can get any movie from anywhere. And it's a huge market potential because right now, fewer than 5% of HDTVs sold in the U.S. have this capacity. So if Walmart owns this company that got this into all the HDTVs, it's really a big market, and people would love, I think, would love to be able to, you know, kind of demand whatever they want, whenever they want it on their HDTV.
On-demand movies right to your television. How does Walmart sell this? Do they keep the Vudu name, or do people want to go on their television and say, I just bought a barrel of pretzels and 18 gallons of milk from Walmart. I think I'll buy the latest George Clooney movie from them, too.
So that's the future potential here. The future potential is not only selling movies, but selling anything right on someone's TV, and potentially even, you know, during the movies, having side features that you can buy things on. Vudu has an interesting capacity that other services like Netflix don't have. It links up with Facebook and Twitter and other parts of the internet so that people can really multitask while they're watching movies, and there's a lot of commerce potential, which Walmart is undoubtedly looking at.
Now, is there the potential here for a pop-up while you're watching a movie? You know, if George Clooney puts on a slick suit, you know, click here to buy the suit from Walmart, because I would turn it off in a second, I have to tell you.
That sounds horrible. So, you know, I certainly think they'd be unwise to do that sort of invasive advertising, so they'll have to strike a balance.
Have to strike a balance between utter commerce and the future of movies, right? Well, Louise Story from our partner, the New York Times finance reporter, joining us to tell us that Walmart, hey, they're in the pretzel business, they're in the wholesale chicken business, why not the movie business? That's where the money is. Louise, thanks so much. Coming up, we'll talk about how your bank may soon try to attach unnecessary fees to your debit card if they haven't already. As we talked about earlier this week on The Takeaway, Congress has already cracked down on credit cards. There was plenty of smoke and mirrors in credit cards before. Well, now they might be turning to debit cards, because smoke and mirrors is also where the money is. In banking, that's coming up in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, if you think credit cards are the only things that have hidden fees on them, we're going to talk more about banks are finding ways to add hidden fees to your debit cards, which a lot of people use. That's coming up in just a few moments.
Right now, here's a check on some top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. There was a rare moment of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill last night as five Republican senators broke ranks with their party and voted to advance a Democratic jobs bill. The atmosphere surrounding health care is different, though. President Obama set out his proposals for reform yesterday. Earlier, we spoke to Trudy Lieberman from the Columbia University Journalism Review, who told us part of the president's plan is lowering the penalties for those who don't buy insurance.
Which, of course, raises the question whether people will take these lower penalties now, or will they buy insurance at some price, and we don't know what the price is.
Republicans say the president's proposals are nothing new.
Moving now to Afghanistan, where the Pentagon now says 21, not 27, Afghan civilians were killed by a NATO airstrike on Sunday. Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen expressed regret.
I do offer my heartfelt condolences not only to the loved ones of those killed in this incident, but to the Afghan people themselves, and to the family and friends of all those killed or wounded thus far in this operation, Afghan and coalition alike.
It was the third NATO airstrike to kill civilians this month. Here at home, even as Americans were footing the bill for the financial bailouts, Wall Street paid out over $20 billion of bonuses last year. That's up 17% from a year earlier. New York officials say the profit for all of Wall Street could top $55 billion. And millions of Americans are tweeting every day. Twitter, though, still far behind Facebook when it comes to users. Twitter had 24 million unique visitors last month. That sounds like a lot until you know that Facebook had 134 million unique users. Taking a look at the markets are now open. The Dow has dropped 17 points. The S&P is down a little over a point, and the NASDAQ is down about 5 points. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
This week, a new credit card bill takes effect after many complaints about hard-to-understand statements and ballooning fees and interest rates that fluctuate. We've heard lots from our listeners on the subject.
This is Kelly from South Carolina. I'm currently living without any credit card. I've removed myself from the banking system just because of the outrageous overdraft fees and whatnot. I may reconsider entering again once
the new law passes that would limit their ability to overdraft charge and the crazy fees and whatnot.
Well, the new government crackdown is on complex fees and fines that may only add pennies per person, sometimes more than that, but they account for billions of dollars to the banks. And we want to talk about one type of fee that the government is now trying to rein in, automatic overcharge protections. Now, this is on your debit card, not on your credit card. Ron Lieber is a personal finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He also edits the Bucks blog, and he's been watching overdraft fees like a hawk. And Mark Sorensen, he's an architect in Dallas, Texas, and Ron's article quotes Mark and says that he found out the hard way that breaking out of a financial commitment when it comes to overdrafts with the banks these days is hard to do. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Ron Lieber from The Times. Let me start with you. People by now are all too familiar with some of the ways the banks can use what amounts to smoke and mirrors to squeeze extra money out of customers. How does it work with overdraft?
Well, the way that it's worked over the last several years is that people are often automatically signed up for overdraft protection so that when they go to a store and use their debit card to attempt to make a purchase or when they go to an ATM machine to withdraw money, the bank will allow them to spend or take out more than they have and then charge them up to $35, sometimes more, each time they do it for the privilege.
So this is similar in a way to giving credit cards maybe to people who couldn't afford them and then charging them exorbitant fees for the fact that they can't afford them, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would go that far, but the problem that many consumers have with this was that this is not something that they asked for, and many people would in fact prefer to have the bank cut them off when they don't have money, as opposed to letting the charge go through sometimes repeatedly, six or seven times a day, and then ending up with a couple hundred dollars in fees. They would just assume that the banks, cut them off and say, no, actually, you can't make that purchase. You can't make the withdrawal because you don't have money left. Again, this is something that they did not sign up for.
Now, Mark Sorensen, you turned to your bank, which I believe was Bank of America, to try to get out of your overdraft protection arrangement, correct?
That's correct.
And what happened when you tried to do that?
Well, I went into the bank and asked to be removed from the program, and they didn't have a problem with that. While they were waiting for the account to come up, the banker asked me if I was aware that I wouldn't be protected from any overdrafts from now on, and was I also aware that there would be occasions when a company would be able to put a hold on my account. That I wasn't aware of, and so I didn't say anything at the time. It wasn't until after I left that I started to try to figure out, in this instance, as a gas station would put a hold on my account, whether or not I would still have money in the account to be able to buy or purchase any other transactions.
So in other words, make your life a heck of a lot more inconvenient, I guess. Mark Sorensen, did you get the sense at all that the bank was trying to scare you or intimidate you into staying with a program that you would ultimately have to pay more money for?
Well, I went in with the understanding that I was determined to make the change, and I knew that that would be presented with the option that, or at least be presented with an argument that I should consider what I was doing. And I didn't want to go through any kind of conversation in which I would be put in a position where I would have to go through that conversation.
They're asking you to think twice there. Well, I want to point out that we did turn to Bank of America for their comment on this story since they are Mark's bank. And I'll read you their statement here. We are not encouraging customers to remain in overdraft services, but ensuring they clearly understand the implications, end quote. That's a statement from Bank of America that they sent us this morning. Ron Lieber from The New York Times, there's got to be a lot of money at stake for the industry, and it occurs to me that maybe they're giving up some major profit potential now that a credit card bill of rights and crackdowns are passing in Congress. Are they likely to turn more heavily towards overdraft now to try to scoop up some more money?
Well, here's what's at stake. It's about $20 billion. That's billion with a B like boy, just from these two types of overdrafts that are now subject to these new Federal Reserve rules, the ATM withdrawals and the one-time purchase in a store with a debit card. They would prefer that this money not disappear from their revenue stream. And so, you know, while it's certainly up to consumers what choice they make, you know, the banks at various points may, you know, engage in the art of subtle or perhaps not so subtle persuasion or even scare tactics, depending on the individual banker and how aggressive they are in the branch, to try and convince people that it's in their interest to keep overdraft turned on. Because if, you know, 80 or 90% of their customers don't raise their hand and opt in, which is what the new rule requires, you have to now raise your hand as of this summer.
Oh, that's
the
difference. That's the difference.
Right.
Well,
what's changing.
Ron Lieber, are there consumers out there for whom overdraft protection is probably a good thing and it benefits them? How do you know if you're one of the people who should stick with it?
Sure. There are some people who treat this, you know, as another form of credit. And when they're, you know, down to the, you know, the last dollar, you know, because they're living hand to mouth, you know, every 2 weeks, if they're lucky enough to have a paycheck at this point and still be employed, you know, they can find this a convenience that's worth having. But for people who, you know, who don't intend to do this or don't want to pay the fees, you know, they were offered paying the fees or enrolled in this program without their knowledge before, either because they didn't read the fine print or the bank simply never told them. And there are going to be a good number of these people who don't raise their hand and say they want to be in it anymore.
And the lesson here is you got to watch your bank like a hawk. Ron Lieber is with the New York Times. Mark Sorensen is an architect in Dallas, Texas, who's been fighting overdraft fees himself. Gentlemen, thank you. Coming up, we give you a behind-the-scenes look at exactly who we're fighting in the Afghan war. Frontline has been to Afghanistan and has a new documentary made by our partner WGBH. That's coming up.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlay. By all accounts, 2009 wasn't great for a lot of people, but it may have been really bad for Kwame Kilpatrick. Not only did he lose his job as mayor of Detroit, he served 4 months in jail. He had to surrender his law license after the details of a spicy text message sex scandal came to light. And now the FBI believes Kwame Kilpatrick used his office in a criminal enterprise and accepted bribes of more than $100,000. We're joined now by Jim Schaefer. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist for the Detroit Free Press. He joins us from Detroit, and he's co-author of the new book called Kwame Sutra, which collects quotes from the man referred to as Hisner in Detroit. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Celeste.
So this is how the FBI describes it, as a criminal enterprise. What are they talking about?
Yeah, this is a really big development for Kwame Kilpatrick, and as you mentioned, it's probably one of the worst days that he's had so far in his short life. But what that means is that the feds, for the first time, have we've discovered that they are investigating this case as if it is an organized crime unit that was running the city of Detroit when Kwame Kilpatrick was in charge. This is the law that the government used to go after mafia dons back in the 1980s and clear most of those fellas out. So this is a very serious charge if it's filed, and again, no charges that have been filed, but each count would carry a 20-year prison sentence if he's found guilty.
That means that he had people in his office colluding then, if he's a so-called boss.
Yeah, that's right. To prove RICO, you have to have six or more participants. They've already indicted 11 people in this case. Some of those folks are alleged to be part of the conspiracy, and they've got many more coming, we are told by our sources.
His mother is going to have to run for Congress again. Last time, she had a very, very rough time. In fact, had to spend a large amount of money in order to do a media blitz that got her back in. Is this going to be difficult for her?
Yeah, you know, she barely squeaked through the last time, and it's probably because she had more than one Democratic opponent. This time, if there's an able challenger, she may be in the fight of her life for re-election.
Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick is Kwame Kilpatrick's mother, and she's been in Congress for a very long time. What's the earliest we may get more news from the FBI about this case?
Well, there's no telling. You know, you can't tell the FBI when to work on our timetable, but Kwame Kilpatrick is going to be in the news again this week. In fact, this morning, his lawyers are due back in court because he has a separate state case, that text message scandal that you were referring to. And he is allegedly in violation of his parole on, or his probation, I should say, on that case for not paying back enough money toward his $1 million in restitution. So he may actually end up in jail again sometime this week.
But he's argued that the $1 million he doesn't have the money.
Yeah, but prosecutors proved convincingly to a judge over the last 4 months that Mr. Kilpatrick had several hundred thousand dollars go through his bank account in the last year. So they don't believe him. They want more money. We'll see what happens.
So in our good week, bad week suggestions for Friday, I'm going to go ahead and suggest Kwame Kilpatrick. Thanks so much to Jim Schaefer. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist for the Detroit Free Press. Actually won the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the text message scandal that involved Kwame Kilpatrick and one of his staffers. Thanks so much for joining us. Jim Schaefer is also the author of the new book called The Kwame Sutra. Very funny book.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, a behind-the-scenes look at exactly who we're fighting in Afghanistan. There's a new documentary from Frontline. We'll be talking more about it in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Federal prosecutors have launched a criminal investigation into Toyota's safety problems. Company executives and Toyota owners will testify on Capitol Hill today and tomorrow. One of those owners is Rhonda Smith, whose Lexus accelerated 100 miles per hour on an interstate. She tells ABC News she alerted safety regulators to the danger years ago, but they never listened.
I tried to get that across to them before, 4 years ago. I tried to get it across to them that something should have been done about the situation, about the danger of the cars.
In an opinion piece published in the Wall Street Journal today, Toyota's president has acknowledged that his company made serious mistakes.
In New York, terrorism suspect Najib Boulazizi pled guilty in a federal court yesterday. He faces life in prison without parole. In Germany, thousands of Lufthansa pilots back at work today after only 1 day of the planned 4-day strike, but normal flight schedules aren't expected to resume until Friday. And finally, at the Olympic Games in Vancouver, the U.S. took a silver medal in ice dancing yesterday, losing gold to the Canadians. Today, freestyle skating, figure skating, and bobsledding are some of the events on the agenda. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Now, we hear about the war in Afghanistan almost every day, and a lot of that coverage on this program, of course, but it's rare to get an up-close, first-hand account of exactly who we're fighting there. But tonight, our partners at WGBH Frontline have an exclusive report that does exactly that. It's called Behind Taliban Lines. To get some dramatic footage, Afghan journalist Najibullah Qureshi was blindfolded and taken deep into Balgan province to document the lives of the insurgents who were working to destabilize the American and German forces in that area. That's in the north of Afghanistan. Qureshi's camera rolled as insurgents slept, as they prayed for martyrdom, as they constructed and planted IEDs and roadside bombs along the main road in and out of the region. So we're joined now by Najibullah Qureshi and his producer, Jamie Duran. They come to us from our BBC studios in London. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Najibullah, it's fascinating at the top of the piece that you reported in Frontline how you were approached by the Taliban. You were working on a different story, and you were contacted by the Taliban and invited into their midst. Can you describe that?
Yeah, basically like that. I was working for another project for Frontline, and while I was working there, a guy approached me, and I was one of his favorite reporters while I was working in Afghanistan. So I make it short, and basically he offered me, he said, I know one of Taliban's commander, and on that subject, if you want their idea, then I can make it. So I agreed, and the next day he called me, he said that the commander agreed and he wanted to meet you. So I went there, and crossing some rivers and all these things, then I meet him and I did interview with him. And at the end of the interview, and he offered me that if you can come and join our Mujahideen. But I asked how. Then he said, I have to talk with my boss, and if he agreed, then we will call you. So this was like that. And after a month, when I came back to London, then they called me as a guest. So then I went inside.
Now, Najibullah, you say that, you were invited to join the Mujahideen, and then at one point you were challenged in that way, but in a very different way, when you came under suspicion yourself and were invited to join the Mujahideen, but to pick up a gun and prove that you weren't a spy.
Basically, the commander invited me over there. So when I went there, there was not only commander. He had lots of people, and the council also, they have the council. And the commander, when I explained to him that I'm not a spy, I'm a journalist and all these things, he was okay. But the rest of the people, they didn't believe me, that they were saying I'm a spy. And even they were so rude with me, and they were not talking with me. They were not open. So that's why I went to... I put my life in risk, and I went to the operation, which they did.
Now, Jamie Duran, your reporter Najibullah spent time crouching with Taliban fighters, filming them as they constructed IEDs, and talking to them about their beliefs. What after all this time that your cameras spent with them, what did you learn about who we're fighting? What's driving them?
I think in many ways, you have to go back. I was there, obviously, during the war in 2001. And the Western forces were very much the liberating forces at that time. Then someone unfortunately had the idea of going into Iraq. Afghanis felt abandoned indeed to the corruption of their own government. And so when the focus returned to Afghanistan, I'm afraid that we're now seen as the invaders, and that's very important. We are seen as the kuffar, the non-believers, and the invaders. And so I guess what came clear from the film is that these fellows will not give up until the foreign forces leave. This they're very determined about. And the other thing that comes through from the rushes, remember, you will see 52 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever tonight, but in the rest of the footage, it comes through the film and through the rushes that every single one of them is ready to die. In fact, not even ready to die, they want to die.
Hoping to die. Well, Jamie Duran, you mentioned that it was about foreign invaders, and what struck me was the simplicity of the motivation of many of these fighters. Many of them said, we only fight because foreign invaders are on our land. When they leave, we put down our guns. It was not a grand vision of an Islamic caliphate. It was not destroying New York. It was, invaders are on our land.
That's absolutely right. I mean, Afghans are a strange old lot, as Naj would confirm, and they're very much broken into ethnic groups. But the one thing that unites them is the fear and the opposition, if you like, to foreigners coming into their land. As I say, we were liberators once, we're invaders now. The feeling we got is that they have no intention of giving up until... In fact, some of them said that perhaps once the foreigners leave, then we'll turn around and ask the Taliban, you know, the leadership, that they should maybe go back to Pakistan also. I find that quite significant.
I want to ask you, Najibullah Qureshi, but before we have to go, some of the footage is very compelling as you crouch with these fighters while they're mounting an attack on a highway, and you're with them essentially as they install IEDs and even detonate them during an attack. Did you have any misgivings about laying in wait with them, not informing a UN convoy or Americans that their lives were at risk by an attack that was being mounted?
When they try to do these things, make IEDs and all these things, first of all, they didn't allow me to film that. And then Jamie knows I'm really pushy when I'm on the land, when I'm working. So I was asking to please give me just 10 seconds or 5 seconds or 10 seconds like this. So I was filming all 1 hour I did film. So when they went, it was during night, 1-2 o'clock at night, and they didn't took me to the main road where they grow or where they put it on the road. But I was away like 30-50 meters away from the road.
Well, it's just some very compelling footage, I have to say, and people should check out Frontline tonight to see just how compelling Najibullah Qureshi's footage of his time with the Afghan Taliban. He joined us from our studios in London along with his producer, Jamie Duran. Gentlemen, thank you both. You can see footage of Taliban insurgents making an IED in a preview of Frontline's Behind Taliban Lines documentary. Just go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Actually, we have a lot of things on the website right now relating to many of the stories that we've reported on lately, whether it's from credit cards to our series, Frustration Nation. Also, our work segment. We talked today about if you're looking for a job, and we talked about the strange questions that have been appearing on applications. One of them was if you walked into a room, what would be your theme song? Many of you answered that question for us and even sang to us.
My name's Steve Weinstein. I'm on my way to work. The song that I like best, which represents me, is Rocky.
This is Jenny Hutchinson calling from Southfield, Michigan. If I were to walk into the room, I would have Wonder Woman playing as my theme music.
This is Gratian from Gig Harbor, Washington. My theme music when I walk into a room.
Well, you can tell by the way I use my walk.
Staying alive.
We have the world's best listeners. Give us your theme song or any take, 8778-MY-TAKE, right at our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
Toss Willick, it's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.